Hey, this is James Tiley with Johnny Fry. Another week in, I want to say it's Friday, November 12th, that we're recording. And we have some great guests coming up in part two of our show. But this is the main one right here, where we go over the newsletter that Johnny, JONNY Fry, that you can find on LinkedIn or Team Blockchain. He will explain to you how to get this newsletter. And then, of course, when you listen to our follow-up show, you'll know what we're talking about. Make sense, Johnny?
I think it does. Yeah, it's well, as we said before, it's basically we do a weekly analysis looking at sort of how, where, and why blockchain technology and digital assets are being used in different industries in different jurisdictions. And the idea of the analysis is really more educational. There's no recommendations. We don't give investment advice. We're not authorized to do that at Team Blockchain, and neither are Cyber.fm. They're not authorized as well. So we're really trying to. This is a place where you can just a safe space where we talk about how the technology is being used and how it's going to impact on your business, on your lives, and society. So we've been doing it now for coming up for nearly it'll be 4 years in March. So it's and it goes all across the world. Obviously, Cyber.fm, you go to over 4.6 million listeners. You listen to you, and we send this out to thousands of people in across Europe and Asia. So yeah, so it's just great to be back on the air with yourselves, James, and just talk about some of the things we've been looking at this week.
Yeah, this was a good newsletter. This is one of those that were right up my alley. I'm sure you'll start to cover them.
Yeah, so one of the things we looked at was what are the challenges facing sort of NFTs, and if you look at the NFT market, if you look at as a website called nonfungible.com. And their statistics, as I'm talking, as you say, on the 12th of just the 12th of November, they reckon in the last 24 hours, something like 14,000 transactions, equating to something in the order of 36 million worth of transactions have happened, just in NFTs, and over the last year. There's an incredible just under 6 million transactions and $10 billion worth of active selling of NFTs. But NFTs, it's funny, I was speaking at a conference in London in the UK only yesterday, and the whole essence and the people that were there, it reminded me a little bit, James, of sort of 2016 when we just started seeing people talking about things called initial coin offerings, ICOs, and people saw this as a way to a new way of raising money. And it was interesting yesterday at the conference, DeFi Live was the conference, and it was mainly around decentralized finance and that sector, which is obviously going and growing very, very quickly. But people were looking at non-fungible tokens saying, well, yeah, well, I want to raise some money because I've got a really good idea and I'm going to sell my idea as an NFT. A non-fungible token, and you just worry a little bit about this. But what's interesting is, if you like, the number of or the types of institutions that are getting involved now in this, and we're seeing all across the world, different sports clubs. Obviously, the NBA in the States has been huge into this. We're seeing the film industry. You've got nearly all the big film producers in certainly in Hollywood are now looking to use non-fungible tokens. But one of the problems that we face, I think, with non-fungible tokens is a lot of these non-fungible tokens have been built off the back of Ethereum-powered blockchain platforms. And as we touch in another article in this week's Digital Bytes, the cost of dealing or on the Ethereum blockchain. That the actual cost of using that platform can vary and swing around quite a lot. And so whilst you might be dealing with companies like OpenSea or Rarible, these companies are typically dependent on the underlying costs of blockchain, which or doing transactions on blockchain, which is not a problem if you're buying and selling something like the Bored Ape Yacht Club on Rarible, which is currently out there for 88 million. In the last 30 days, that's the sort of turnover that was done. But when you look at the average transaction. And over the year, we've seen that the average NFT has been sold for $1,691. But there are literally thousands, tens of thousands of NFTs at the moment, which, you know, they're selling for sort of $200 or $300. And if all of a sudden you find that the cost, the transaction fees could cost you $50 or $100, you start saying, wow, it's substantially increasing the cost of NFT for smaller investors. And what we've seen is a proliferation of these sites. As I say, you've got Rarible, OpenSea, Super Rare. And these are different types of platforms where you can sell different types of NFTs depending on what you're actually doing. But one platform that caught our eye is a new one that's coming out called Melon. And what Melon is doing is actually is really focusing on social media influencers. So they've picked 120 what they believe are sort of, you know, well-known social media influencers. And these people have between them over 300 million followers. And what they're trying to do is to actually engage their community group with different videos or different pictures and different things they've done. And it gives these social media influencers a new form of income, because basically anyone that's got some form of IP, i.e. intellectual property, so it could be a picture, it could be a song, it could be a film, it could be something in the physical world which you can then create in a digital format and then share the digital version of that. So to put that a little bit more clearly, if you take somewhere like a museum, you know, museums all over the world have got a fraction of the items that they own are actually on display. But what they can do is actually all the literally tens of thousands of items which are held in dusty cupboards and in vaults, you know, behind the scenes where the public never see them, they can actually bring those into the digital environment, and then they can sell people and they can have the digital rights to, you know, maybe a prehistoric bone, or it may be, you know, a Leonardo da Vinci painting. So there's some huge interesting opportunities of creating real value using NFTs for all sorts of different industries, which makes it, you know, really, really quite exciting, James.
You know, I'm not going to lie. I've been into NFTs since before anybody knew what NFTs were, right? Back in, like, we had CryptoKitties back in 17. But I take issue with the capability of what an NFT can do in comparison to what we're doing. Maybe I'm older. Maybe I'm a tightwad. I just can't imagine myself sitting down with a VC, right? I want to convince this venture capitalist to invest in CyberFM a little bit and, you know, secure our future and his own. And I break out a Donald Trump Mr. Potato Head NFT. It just doesn't... I get it. I like it. It's art. And social media, it's gone the way of Hollywood. The NFTs have gone the way of Hollywood. And I don't think a lot of people realize, and this is my soapbox, I guess, people don't realize that NFTs can maintain the mortgage to your home, the registration to your car, your marriage license, your retirement. And we're pushing Cardi B. I don't know how the industry took that route. And I don't disagree that it's wrong. I don't think it's wrong. I just think it's odd, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, no, I think it makes a lot of sense. I think it makes a lot of sense. And, you know, some of the NFTs clearly have some tangible value. I don't think you can question that. Some of them you just think, really? So what's it actually backed by? And when we see the hype and we're seeing it, and that's why I go back to yesterday's event in London and talking to, you know, there must have been 400 or 500 people at this event. And they would, it was like, tell me more about NFTs. And I want to build my business around NFTs. And you think, oh, hang on. You know, you're now straying very, you know, I was talking to a scientist who does a lot of work in stem cells. And he was saying, look, I've got some great ideas and I want to turn my ideas into an NFT. And I said, well, that's great. I said, but how would you feel if I wandered into your laboratory and I started playing with your test tubes and you fiddled with your Bunsen burner and took a couple of pipettes? He said, what do you mean? I said, well, if I came into your space and started fiddling around, and I'm not a scientist, I'm certainly not a doctor like yourself. He said, well, we would get security and we'd get you to leave. And I said, well, but you're kind of doing that in my space. You know, I've been in the financial services sector on and off for nearly 40 years. And if you start coming in and doing things like raising money, handling clients' assets, potentially creating a collective investment scheme, from a US perspective, maybe you're going to be standing on the footsteps of or even on the feet of the Howey test. You know, these things are very serious. And you could find that it's not me asking you to leave my industry. You could find, you know, the police or the Fed or the FCA saying, look, hang on, you better come this way, sir, because what you've done is illegal. And I think people need to be very, very careful because fortunately, unfortunately, depending on which way you look at it, you know, NFTs potentially can touch on the regulatory side of life, and people need to be certain that what they're doing is legally correct. And the challenge is because you can create an NFT, and I think Axie Infinity is a great example, and it's probably turned over more money than any other sort of collection of NFTs with, you know, their game. It developed in Vietnam, and their biggest market is in the Philippines. Well, how much legal advice did the Vietnamese developers take when they said, well, okay, let's look into the Philippine market? They probably had no idea that it was going to be so popular. So I do agree. I think people need to be careful. It's not the panacea. Some great ideas. And we're seeing some huge companies, you know, Visa have been involved in buying this. And we're seeing some other companies that have got involved in this space. But you just think, you know, where is this going to end? You know, we've got coming up on the 18th of November, the auction house Sotheby's are holding an auction, and they're saying they're happy to start taking Bitcoin and Ethereum. They're going to be holding an auction of NFTs in Decentraland. So this is, you know, this is now getting into the metaverse, which obviously we were talking about last week, that Facebook are invading that sort of space. So really exciting, but just be careful when you get involved. And that was the idea behind the article. Just be careful because there are some challenges. It's not just a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, which some people seem to think at the moment.
Right. And I think it's great. It's especially for art, right? I'd love to see it grow into, like I said, car registrations, mortgage, you know, titles, ease of use for people, as opposed to, like you said, some scientists trying to get into the financial technology industry. Just do what you do and use an NFT as a way to present it to a different audience. Again, the Vietnamese game company, was it Axiom?
Yeah.
Impact in the Philippines, they're probably like, whoa, what's going on here? So it's for introducing your product, absolutely. I was just shocked originally that it went the whole way of Hollywood, which is weird to me.
Yeah. Well, you know, and we've seen it on the Hollywood side. We've seen there's a film with Anthony Hopkins, you know, pretty well-known actor. I mean, all sorts of films. And there's a film that currently Hollywood have actually managed to raise $20 million by selling NFTs to finance the cost of creating that film. And each NFT will entitle the owner of the NFT, if you like, viewing rights to be able to watch it and see it. So it's, think of it almost as a digital ticket. So they're experimenting, seeing, well, could this be a way to stop sort of file sharing and sort of hacking? And is this a more secure way that, you know, these films are really expensive to produce. Right. And if the, you know, production companies can't stop the sort of the informal economy and people sort of hacking in and looking at them, then, you know, they're not going to be able to continue to make these films. So they're looking at ways to use the technology potentially to make it more secure, and they can have a little more control over the content that they create. So interesting to see how this is going to evolve. Certainly a lot of time, a lot of money, a lot of hype. So again, you know, just a note of caution, I suppose, but more than anything around that.
In the same breath, we have the show out here called The Walking Dead. They film a lot of it right by my house. And they rolled out a commercial for the new Walking Dead NFTs on mainstream TV. You know, they didn't explain what an NFT was. They didn't say how to get it. They just said, get ready for your all-new collectible Walking Dead NFTs. And then I became that guy. I was like, shut up and take my money.
Well, you know, it's it's interesting. And, well, one of the other articles we wrote this week was looking at the challenges of digital rights on digital assets, because, you know, if you're now going to, you know, you're going to put your pictures on social media as an example, and I know a number of people this has happened to, both as professional photographers and also as amateur photographers, and they've taken a picture of a stunning sunset or a beach or maybe some wild animals or some birds or something like that. And then suddenly, you know, they find that their picture has been, because they've posted it up on a social media site or it's gone into the, you know, the World Wide Web somehow. And they suddenly find that, you know, that's been taken by maybe, I don't know, a binoculars manufacturer or a camera manufacturer saying, oh, we thought that image was really great. And that a great way to show this is the sort of thing that can be done by you if you use our equipment. And so these digital, how do you protect your digital rights? And so we were looking at this, and you know, one of the big areas that we mentioned a minute ago was things like Axie Infinity and Decentraland and things like that, where these virtual games, and we're seeing this terminology, GameFi, which is sort of the gaming industries, but it's coming into sort of the finance sector, because players are actually earning money as they play. And according to crypto.com, this asset classification is worth something like $28 billion already, and it's growing really, really quickly. So what are your intellectual property rights? And we sort of believe it or not, the whole thing around copyright actually, you know, has its roots to a great extent in the Swiss town of Bern, the Bern Convention, which goes back to 1886. I don't know what happened, but they waited until 1979 before they amended it. And it talks about some of the things that you need to be considerate of, and some of the rights that you have around your copyright and how you protect your IP. And in Europe, within the EU, they actually came up with something called the Information Society Directive. And that initially came about in 2001. And again, recently that's been updated in 2019, and whereby all the EU members over here in Europe were meant to be going to implementing this new legislation, which would try and take into account some of the digital aspects. We were then looking in North America, obviously, where Cyber.fm are based, and I know you've got a lot of listeners there, and there the digital IP, what they're saying, it's got to meet the same criteria as the physical creative work. So the work has to be fixed in some tangible medium that can be perceived, reproduced, communicated either by itself or with the aid of a machine. And copyright protection begins as soon as the work has been created and fixed in a tangible medium. Well, and then potentially the owner or creator of that IP has got protection for 70 years after their death. But how do you actually have something in the tangible medium when you're creating something in a virtual game or in a metaverse? And so you can see here where some of the challenges, you think you've created something, you spend a lot of time in the virtual virtual reality, and then you actually find that actually maybe you've got no legal protection over the work that you've done, or even you've spent considerable sum of money on buying one of these digital assets. And you find that, well, did the actual owner have title to sell it to you? So one of the companies we've been looking at is a company called File Protected, and that's based in Los Angeles and in California. And what they're doing is saying, look, you can register your IP onto a blockchain. So if you've taken a picture, you've written a song, you've got a script for a film, you've got an image. You've got something that you want to register. It could be just as simple as an email. So you want to prove that I sent this to you, and you can log it onto a blockchain for a tiny time. You know, we're looking at, you know, something like, I think they're talking about something like less than $10 for, you know, a couple of hundred things a month you could do. So it's a tiny amount of money. But then at least you can prove I actually, you know, I on this date in November 2021, I actually registered this on a blockchain. So can you prove to me, James, where did you get that picture from? When did you register it? And whilst this isn't a completely safe way, it's a step towards trying to prove some sort of authenticity. Because, again, the concern with digital assets is, did you actually create them? Do you actually own them? Or have you bought them from someone that actually didn't actually own them? And that's, it's a big challenge, and there's no simple answer. But we're going to have to come up with a better frame of rules and regulations on a global basis, because, you know, there's a lot of money at stake, and people are going to start hacking, and they're going to start trying to, you know, sort of swindle people out of cash if they think it's open game and anyone, any old mug can, you know, be defrauded almost.
So I'd hate to make this about me. Unfortunately, I'm the only example that I can come up with, right? Because your two articles here work together. You have NFTs specifically for the music industry, and we're talking about copyright protection. Now, I hate to do it, but I have no choice. CyberFM, our parent company, our corporation, right, is known as Distributed Ledger Performance Rights Organization, and we call it DL Pro. And what we're saying is our business intention outside of the rock and roll and the Johnny Fry interviews, the business intention is to allow universal royalties only specifically and strictly for streaming audio, or what you would call radio, right? Yeah. Now, you touch upon this in the article. There is not one copyright rule globally.
Yeah.
When we play Cardi B or Billie Eilish, Aerosmith and Metallica, when we play that in the United States, we pay the United States government X amount of a royalty. We pay it to the government. We pay it to an organization appointed by the government to ensure that the appropriate copyright holders receive their share. And basically in the United States, that's a company called ASCAP, BMI, and CSAC. And then Canada, we have SOCAN.
And then we have the Performing Rights Society here in the UK.
You have PRS. In the, exactly. And you also have GRS. It might be Germany. But the rules are different there. And that's the point. The rules are different in Germany and the UK as they are in Canada and the United States, just for me, the guy that you're talking to. Mm-hmm. So when we created DL Pro, our intention, and we're doing it, we're pulling it off. The idea of a global currency for global copyrights, specifically for music, right? So that it doesn't matter if you're played in the Philippines, they have what's called PhilsCap, which is, I guess, a play off of like ASCAP. So it's impossible, not impossible, but absolutely non-motivating to try to keep all of these different laws on book for CyberFM. We don't want to pay 19 different countries, 19 different rates because of 19 different laws. It's impossible to do. It's an overhead nightmare. So that's why we have that other token that we never talk about. But it's supposed to be used so that we create a universal currency to support a universal copyright law. And then we're setting it up where the PRS and ASCAP, BMI, CSAC, mm-hmm. SOCAN. They could all plug in, like a plug and play into this blockchain that they are now automatically compatible with. So when the money and the payments get sent to the Performance Rights Society in the UK, they can then convert it. They disperse it to the artist however they do it. That's on them. But they got paid, yep. which is the important part in the music business, just getting paid. Now, with NFTs...
This is just a great example of how the blockchain technology is being used to actually solve a real problem in the music industry, which, to be fair, most of us as listeners, we don't care, if I'm honest. Right. We don't really care. But we ought to, because, you know, you've got it. We've seen examples of, you know, certain performers won't go on certain streaming sites like Spotify or Apple because they don't feel they're getting a fair crack of the whip. They're not getting what they think they're legally entitled to. And if we don't sort it out, then we might find some of the artists we want to listen to, you can't listen to them sort of digitally or online on different platforms. But if the artists feel they're being looked after and paid accordingly for their work, then hopefully then their work is going to be more accessible for everyone.
And that's why they're moving to NFTs, because NFTs give you the, I'm going to say this correctly, NFTs give you the sense that you are in control of your copyrighted material.
Absolutely.
Better. But there's a problem. There's a problem, and I can only speak on music. The problem is this. You write a song, you record it, it's the Johnny Fry all-time band, and everybody loves it, and you release it as an NFT, but you also want it on Spotify. Spotify buys your NFT for $1,000 and then plays it to millions of listeners. You only made $1,000. It's almost as if, and I don't want to say any, I'm not saying Spotify, but I'm just example of a large CyberFM. CyberFM buys the NFT and we play it, but you've only gotten that payment once. So the NFT does not solve the recurring microtransactions that you rightfully deserve alone, regardless of the blockchain or not. The NFT doesn't resolve that issue. And that's where we come in. We are now, when the NFTs became a big deal, we said, okay, we need to figure out how to take the Johnny Fry all-time band NFT, make it plug and play to our distributed ledger system so that you can receive your regular recurring microtransactions as a royalty payment outside of your NFT. However, your NFT still is the item, and maybe that's where we start saying that your NFT becomes your tangible item that declares the Distributed Ledger Performance Rights Organization is rightfully using your music and you're expecting XYZ in payments. That's
James,
going
I
to be...
I think what we ought to do, because I know we've got a break coming up and we've got some. I think we ought to revisit this and get one of your colleagues to let's do a little article on this and get them on the show, because I think this is it's, you know, NFTs are solving some of the problem, but they're not meeting the whole thing, and there's other things that can work with it. So I think it'd be great to get someone from your holding company to, you know, get them to come on the show and let's discuss this, you know, as a guest. I think it's fascinating because we all listen and love music. And we want to make sure the right thing is actually happening.
The Johnny Fry all-time band.
I don't think they want to listen to me yak on. But James, so coming up after the break, we've got Birgit Andersen and we've got Sean Kennan from Greengage, and they're going to be talking about the blockchain landscape. And as I mentioned earlier on, if anyone wants a copy of Digital Bytes, it comes out every Wednesday. They can either contact you, James Tiley, obviously at cyber.fm, or contact myself, Johnny Fry, J-O-N-N-Y Fry, on LinkedIn, or Just contact James and he can put you in contact and we'll send you, it's free, about 4,000 words a week, just giving you an idea of different things that are going on in different jurisdictions in the blockchain space. But we'll be back after the break, James.
Yep, we'll be back in 2 and 2. And by the way, we're going to start making it a lot easier to register for the newsletter, and maybe we'll make some announcements on the next show. But yeah, we'll be back in. We stick our
in a jiffy.
A jiffy, that's the word.
All right, James. Speak to you in a minute.
You are listening to the all new cyber.fm.
Hey, we're back. Johnny brought on some guests. As you know, every time the second half of the show is featured the guest writers from the newsletter that goes out. And this week, Johnny has brought us Sean Kiernan and Birgitta Anderson. And they wrote the article about basically the landscape of the UK blockchain. Johnny, you want to bring them on?
Yeah, sure. So delighted this week, as you say, to be joined by Birgitta and Sean. And I'll get them to just introduce themselves in a second. But wrote an interesting article about, entitled, How is the UK blockchain landscape faring today, post-Brexit, post-COVID? And did some very interesting research into the situation here in the UK, the types of companies, the academic institutions involved, and also really interesting to see that the level of government involvement, or I should say politicians, so it's not just the government, but across all different party, different parties. Birgitta, if you could perhaps, if you could perhaps introduce yourself from the Big Innovation Centre, and then over to Sean, and then we'll crack in and talk about some of the research and things you're doing. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. So I am Birgitta Anderson, the CEO of the Big Innovation Centre, and that is like a think tank and an innovation communications consultancy. We have been working with Green Gates and Deep Knowledge Analytics on a major report where we're landscaping the UK blockchain industry. We have found from the UK blockchain industry that during the COVID period and the kind of the aftermath of Brexit, that the blockchain technology and investment in this has still been going very strong in the UK. Clearly, there has been a lot of technology acceleration. Within this period, we have had about £1.6 billion, or $2.2 billion investment into UK companies within the UK. And here we're talking about mainly small and medium-sized enterprises. And we saw that most of that clearly would have been in the financial hub of Europe called London. So a huge investment in there, in particular in the areas of fintech and crypto trading. As you say, that there are clearly other types, I don't know if Sean would comment on it, but we clearly have other sectors as well that has benefit from it, legal tech and supply chains and logistics. And we found that less investment went into insurtech and gov tech and media and entertainment. So it has really been very financial investment into this.
Brilliant. And Sean, can you perhaps just give us a bit of introductions to what your firm, Green Gage, what it actually does, and why you got involved with Big Innovation Centre and the All Party Parliamentary Group Blockchain APPG, and perhaps just explain a little bit about the background behind that and the sort of MPs that are involved in that sort of affiliation.
Excellent, thank you, Johnny. Sean Kiernan, the CEO of Green Gage. We're a startup looking to be a digital merchant bank. And as of today, we work in facilitating wholesale loans against crypto and also for crypto miners specifically. We're really excited to do this report. Obviously, Birgitta has become a friend in the last couple of years, and also the team at Deep Knowledge Ventures. This is a refresh, really, of a report we did about 3 years ago with the APPG blockchain, which at the time was revolutionary. Nobody had done a systematic profile of the players in the UK blockchain space, not just companies, but also individuals. And what we wanted to do this time is come up with a refresh to explore not just where we are, but where we've come from and where we could be going. One of the most interesting things, I think, in the report is looking, as you mentioned, Johnny, at the parliamentarians and actually who has even said the word blockchain the most in the last couple of years. And we include in the report a profile of the different names of both MPs and members of the House of Lords in terms of just the frequency that they mention things. And we've been obviously impressed that Lord Holmes of Richmond mentioned the most number of times, 29 times. And he's also contributed a short video to explain his view on how blockchain can play a role in innovation in the UK.
Okay, but sure, just on that point. So this isn't just one party in the one political party. These are a number of different parties. And for
I can explain how the all-party parliamentary group on
brilliant.
The blockchain
works. Brilliant, that'd be really helpful.
Literally, this is a cross-party group across House of Commons and House of Lords. We have the two-tier system in the UK. And that group has really, irrespective of political orientation, has come together to think forward with the aim on how we can implement and adopt blockchain in the most effective and efficient way and ensure that regulation is in place for this. This type of group, as the all-party parliamentary group blockchain, is literally a group from what we UK to call backbenchers. That means that whereas ministers can attend and speak at the events, it has really been a driving force with those MPs who got more time. As this is by law in UK Parliament also, that ministers focus on ministerial posts, but non-ministers can get involved in things like the all-party parliamentary group blockchain. And we have seen a lot of participation both across House of Commons and House of Lords in this group. And it is currently, it's been chaired by different people over time, including the person who had to step down because he's now transport minister, Grant Shapps, but there's also been chaired by Damien Moore, another Conservative MP who's now in the cabinet office, so that he had to step down. And now for now, we have Martin Doherty, he's one of the leading Scottish MPs from the National Party in Scotland, and he's current chair. And that shows that we're clearly, you cannot have more policy posts inside Parliament, but we have had a huge, everybody parliamentarians as available is very interested in the EPPD and blockchain. And clearly we have been focusing on areas as clearly digital currencies and digital assets or the crypto economy, but also across other sectors like blockchain's influence on agriculture and manufacturing and non-governmental organizations and charities and the environment sector and health, et cetera. We've done a lot of work on blockchain's role in track and trace for COVID-19. We look into data governance and network governance, and of course, industry applications. And we also sometimes bring use cases in to be showcased for the parliamentarians in Parliament, who often are career politicians, but they don't necessarily know a lot about the blockchain technology. And we show that in Parliament.
Okay, well, blimey, it sounds like if you're chairman of the APP job blockchain, you end up getting a job in government, in the Cabinet Office. You're getting quite a good track record on this, Rigita.
Yeah.
Not that you could possibly comment on that.
No.
Sean, I'm interested. So you did this initial bit of research 3 years ago. In summary, how would you encapsulate what's the differences, what's changed then in 3 years in terms of the use of blockchain or the development, or have we gone from more just people talking about it and now people doing it, or are we still very much jaw, as they would say in America?
I think it's definitely an increasing level of sophistication. And the investment figure, the £1.6 billion that Brigitte mentioned, is a case in point. The interesting thing is, at the early days, blockchain was mentioned across a whole host of industries as a potential almost silver bullet to solve a whole number of issues. We have seen an increasing focus, at least in this country, in financial services applications in crypto and fintech, and that's chronicled in the report. And that, I think, is really where we've seen the most innovation. There are other things going on. I don't want to preclude them. And perhaps I'm a bit focused on the fintech side because of my own background. But we have been intrigued to see the names involved become bigger companies. We've seen some banks actually engage in their own solutions. Obviously, it's still early days. So this is at that curve of innovation, still in the early bit of the hockey stick. But it's good to see it grow up.
And also at the COP26 in Glasgow, that's just been, we have seen there was a discussion on the blockchain's applications and trade finance within the energy sector, and of course in the energy distribution sector itself. So so that's the source of blockchain's impact in some of the bigger global discussions as energy, climate change, health has been really taking force now at international organizations. It's not any longer a fringe thing, it's a core thing that's mentioned.
And would you say then, Brigitte, with some of your contacts you have with sort of parliamentarians, that that there's a greater awareness then of the technology and less of this, oh, blockchain equals Bitcoin equals some sort of crypto scam? Because, you know, for the last 3 or 4 years, those that's been in the industry, that's been very much what people have had to, if you like, re-educate and tell people. Look, one is the technology, the other, Bitcoin is obviously a digital asset.
I think that right now there has got this understanding that blockchain is what we call a general purpose technology. That means that it can be applied across a variety of sectors. Of course, its impact on the money market has always been very important. But now it is how it can be adopted and applied in trade finance and logistics and really about track and trace on different nodes or identities within different sectors is very important. And also blockchain's impact on the construction is a huge area, even for London.
Right. And well, and also I was interested to see the types of universities that are very active in this sector. You've listed out, you know, people like Oxford and Cambridge, Imperial College, King's College in London, and University of Surrey, not far from where I personally live. So interesting to see quite a wide range of different universities that are teaching, if you like, tomorrow's leaders of some of the challenges and opportunities, presumably, around this technology.
Yeah, I think it's been a great signal as well. We've done, obviously in the report, there's a list of quite a few names and some people have called it a Facebook, if you will, of some key people in the space. But as you've mentioned, it's not just the top tier universities, it's across the board. A lot of work's been done from a legal perspective, particularly given the strong tradition of the UK in setting a rule of law. In terms of how do you establish ownership of crypto and how do you look at the tax regime around different types of instruments listing on a blockchain. Some groups in particular that we found interesting are the work being done by the Cambridge Centre for Alternative Finance, for example, who's looking in, as Brigitte mentioned, on the energy side, not just the positives that blockchain can present, but also some of the ESG angles. In terms of the consumption for mining of Bitcoin, for example, across the world, but also more pragmatic research in terms of commercial applications and setting up of companies. This is again early days still on that yield curve, but we are delighted to see that universities are producing really excellent research in this industry.
Right. So this is, I say, it's not just purely being driven by people, commercial people wanting to get involved in this sector because they see it as a sort of a new thing. We're seeing government engagement. We're seeing also research from institutions. So across the range that people are beginning to understand the challenges and opportunities around the technology.
That's, I think, the benefit, what we're trying to also bring about with some of this research is an idea about an industrial strategy, which is something we spoke about at the launch of the report. There is a hub effect, as you've outlined, that can occur if academia, government, and industry work together. And we're hoping that's emerging here. It seems the early days are proving fruitful, but it still needs a lot more work. And we've outlined in our report some of the areas in particular where we think some additional attention needs to be paid to remain competitive.
Yeah, if I can just add to that, I think that the way in which global growth hubs are really being built, and we know that from America, they tend to be very science-based, linked around universities. And in India, they tend to be very supply chain-based. In China, they're often based upon district development. etc. And different countries have to, and UK and Europe has often built growth hubs around accelerators, around big companies or other types of accelerators. So what we find in the UK is that they have actually adopted a little bit of strategy from all the different global regions, because they both, as India, has a very strong supply chain system, a very strong supplier of companies that can supply blockchain solutions or integrate in the adopt blockchain technologies. We also have a very strong entrepreneurial finance system. That's got a lot of venture capital compared to other sectors coming into blockchain. So the VC market and also other topics. We go through the whole financial growth ecosystem and we see that there's a lot of finance going into it. We have a very strong top talent science system, which as has been very much an American strategy. So we have that. But also what UK has, which I think that is special, we have a very big blockchain, what we call third sector. Here we talk about think tanks and events companies. So by having both a very strong industry system, entrepreneurial finance system, science system, technology development system, and the think tanks and events companies, we are really building a global hub on blockchain. And that will be, I'm sure that will become even more clear in 3 years' time.
Yeah, no, that's really helpful, and I must admit, it's interesting. We see from some of the sort of research and some of the analysis that we write about in Digital Bytes. You know, I think we're very, very fortunate in the sense that, you know, we write in English, and there is a lot of work, and there's a lot of academic research that's written in English. And it is a little bit unfair when you look at other languages that just on the web they're just not as much. And English is still very much seen as an international business language, which makes it very hard if you're sort of Spanish or German or French or Italian. We have a client that's Chinese, for example, and our weekly analysis gets translated into Chinese. And we're always quite interested the number of people that are outside of China, because on LinkedIn, you can't get access to LinkedIn. But the number of people that are interested in reading Chinese information on this topic. So I think the UK is very lucky in the sense that we write in English. But before we go, I know that you've got a series of events coming up, Brigitte, on the APPG blockchain, because obviously a lot of the listeners here, that's of interest to them. And I understand that they can log on and they can listen to some of your forthcoming meetings over the next sort of year, 18 months. Is that correct?
That's definitely correct. So in the All-Party Parliamentary Group of Blockchain, we have a website on something we call a blockchain pavilion. So you need to look up on the internet, the All-Party Parliamentary Group of Blockchain, and make sure that you go to the pavilion, or you can go via the Big Innovation Center's website. And when you log into pavilion, then you can sign up for all future coming meetings. And we usually have about almost one per month, but we have probably about 8 per year meetings. And you can sign up to those. They are really, really open for everybody to participate in. There's hundreds participating, so at least to listen into. But also we have been filming them in Parliament for many, many years. So since 2018. So you can also go video, as watch the old videos. They're not just they're filmed, they're recorded, so you can see the history, you can attend the future, and you can download all the publications of it. So and you can even become a member of the group if you want to. There's this way in which you can sign up to become a member.
Brilliant. But to get access to the films and future events, it's free, isn't it? It's because you're very much trying to engage.
Yeah, we have a freemium model. So, you can, so if you don't want to be a member, you can sign up under your freemium model. Like, it doesn't cost anything, but you have to create an account. So we know who's on our list, and particularly Parliament also wants to know who's actually participating, not because of there's any control over it, but just because it's good to see in what direction the UK policy making is going into and who's participating. Yeah.
Okay, and that's the APPG Blockchain Pavilion. Is that correct?
It is the UK. It's basically it's a UK dot pavilion org. You can also go to the www.appd-blockchain.org, and through that one you will go to the portal for the pavilion. Yeah.
Brilliant. Okay.
Or you can go to the biginnovationcenter.com website, and also that's, you can also go via that direction.
Okay.
And you can also just go to Twitter and see, find the APPD blockchain. And their post there, that's also great. When you sign up to an event, you automatically become part of the pavilion, because that's how you, when you sign up, you have to, yes, you sign up. The link goes straight to the pavilion when you sign up to a meet, to an event, and then you're part of it by default.
Brilliant. Okay. And obviously, any readers of Digital Bytes, there's a link to the report, and then a link to all these different parts within there, and more information about APG, and obviously in more information about Greengage and some of the work that you were talking about, Sean. And I know you've got a number of ideas, and presumably as a potential digital merchant bank, you're interested in some of the infrastructure plays and some of the companies coming through, because they'll be needing banking services and possible investment and lending and things like that. So it's great research for your team and your business to be look at companies that hopefully we're doing business with going forward.
Yeah, and we hope it also gives back. We think this is very much a community spirit, and that's still very present. And as interesting as it is for us to get to know the market, we hope it's also interesting for other people to read.
Yeah, no, it's really great. Okay, well, James, sorry, I've hogged the line a little bit this week. Have you got any other queries or questions? Or do you have anything like this in America?
You know, that's what I was going to say. I'm listening to what they're saying, and I'm kind of envious. So, you know, like in Nevada, we're publishing marriage licenses on a blockchain, and that's the big hoorah. We're like, wow, we did that. You go to the UK, you guys are talking to Parliament. You got Lord Holmes. You're getting the entire government involved in things they could do with blockchain. And over here, all we hear about is taxes, which they change throughout the year. So I'm very envious. I'm proud that somebody is at least being progressive like this. And if it's the UK, all right, we'll lead by example. I think it's great.
Yeah, great. Okay. All right. So just before we go, so Bridget, anyone wants more information, obviously they can go on to, as you said, the appg-blockchain.org. And Sean, yeah, if people want more information about Greengage and what they do, or yourself, what's the best way to get hold of yourself?
The website, greengage.co.
Greengage.co. Brilliant. Okay. Well, look, thank you both very much for joining us today. And look forward to hearing more about, how future things going on in the sort of APPG blockchain space, Bridget. And also be very interested, Sean, you know, maybe to get an update as Greengage develops, because I know you've got some really interesting plans, and going to be, I think, very much a company to keep an eye on over the next sort of 12, 18 months as this space develops. But James, I think, as they say, that's a wrap, as they say in Hollywood. But thank you very much for listening. And obviously, if anyone would like more information about Digital Bytes, it's the weekly publication, then either contact James at cyber.fm or myself, Johnny Fry, JONNYFRY. You can find me on LinkedIn. And we'll be back on the air next week with another edition of the Digital Byte Show.
All right. Another successful week.